Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Bhaktivedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada ki jai. Namacharya Haridas Thakur ki jai. Prem Sagaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya. Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shasti Gaur Bhaktivedanta ki jai. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopa Gopida Shama Kunda Radha Kunda Gili Govardhan ki jai. Sri Vrindavan Dham ki jai. Navadup Dham ki jai. Ganga Jamuna Tulsi Bhakti Devi ki jai. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki jai. Go Prevanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschachadesha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gauravakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 15, Verse 42. In the soul,
Ajuhavit,
fixed, Brahmani, unto the spirit, Atmanam, the soul, Avyaye,
unto the inexhaustible.
Translation, thus annihilating the gross body of five elements into the three qualitative modes of material nature, he merged them in one nescience, and then absorbed that nescience in the self, Brahman, which is inexhaustible in all circumstances. Purport, all that is manifested in the material world is the product of Mahatattva Vyakta, and things that are visible in our material vision are nothing but combinations and permutations of such variegated material products. But the living entity is different from such material products. It is due to the living entity's forgetfulness of its eternal nature as eternal servitor of the Lord and its false conception of being a so-called Lord of the material nature that he is obliged to enter into the existence of false sense enjoyment. Thus, a concomitant generation of material energies is the principal cause of the mind's being materially affected. Thus, the gross body of five elements is produced. Maharaj Yudhisthira reversed the action and merged the five elements of the body in the three modes of material nature. The qualitative distinction of the body as being good, bad, or mediocre is extinguished, and again, the qualitative manifestations become merged in the material energy which is produced from a false sense of the pure living being. While one is thus inclined to become an associate of the Supreme Lord, the Personality of Godhead, in one of the innumerable planets in the spiritual sky, especially in Goloka Vrindavan, one has to think always that he is different from the material energy. He has nothing to do with it, and he has to realize himself as pure spirit, Brahman, qualitatively equal with the Supreme Brahman, Parameshwara. Maharaj Yudhisthira, after distributing his kingdom to Parikshit and Vajra, did not think himself emperor of the world or head of the Kuru dynasty. This sense of freedom from material relations, as well as freedom from the material engagement of the gross and subtle encirclement, makes one free to act as the servitor of the Lord, even though one is in the material world. This stage is called the Jivanmukta stage, or the liberated stage, even in the material world. That is the process of ending material existence. One must not only think that he is Brahman, but must act like Brahman. One who only thinks himself Brahman as an impersonalist, and one who acts like Brahman, is the pure devotee. Translation: thus annihilating the gross body of five elements into three qualitative modes of material nature, he merged them in one nescience, and then absorbed the nescience in the self, Brahman, which is inexhaustible in all circumstances. So here we see a whole process described of becoming detached from the material world. So one, in this description, we see that the lower elements get merged into the higher elements. So the senses get merged in the mind, and the mind and the prana, etc. And then everything into the body, and the body into the three gunas, and the gunas into mahatattva, and mahatattva into ahankara, and ahankara into prakriti. And then everything merges, everything in Brahman, first in the soul and then Brahman. So this is more or less figurative in one sense. And it mirrors, or it's a reverse process of the whole creation. So we see that when Mahavishnu glances, Prakriti manifests as Mahatattva. And then Mahatattva manifests gunas, sattva, raja, tamas. And when it goes to tama, it manifests ahankara. And then from ahankara, we get manifested mind, senses, gross material elements. And then the gross material elements form into a body, and the subtle elements and subtle senses in the mind, they belong to the subtle body. And here we have a body for the jiva. And then the jiva becomes attached to that subtle body and that gross body. He begins to enjoy material objects with that gross body in this world. So, the whole process of spiritual life is to detach the Atma from that material body. So it has two stages. One is the detachment process, and if we only get that far, we call it liberation. So we separate the jiva from the gross and subtle bodies, and if we can do that permanently, that's called liberation or mukti. When the impersonalists read these verses, then they say, "Oh, look, Yudhisthira is merging the Atma in Brahman," and then we have impersonal. The jiva becomes Brahman, so to speak. It looks like that here in this verse. And this is not the only place. We'll see in Bhagavad Gita, we also find, I think in chapter 4, there's a whole series of verses about offering the senses into the mind, and into the controlled mind, etc. And then offering the Atma into the Brahman, etc. There's a whole series of verses to based upon the metaphor of sacrifice, that we offer one thing into the other. And something is the fire, something is the spoon, something is the ghee. here we find the same thing, juhava, hutva, juhot, juhavit. This is all means offering and sacrifice. So we're offering one thing into the other. In the 11th canto also we get another description of this for the yogis. So this is a traditional way of describing the detachment of the jiva from the material body, and for the impersonals, of course, it's merging in the Brahman. But we see here it is used for Yudhisthira and the Pandavas, so there's a little bit of a different context, so we cannot quite take it in the same way. But the analogy still applies. That ultimately, we do have to separate the jiva from the material body and the material senses. But there are different ways of doing that. So the yogi has one way of doing it, and that's basically what is described here and in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam, in reference to the yogi, more details are given of how he merges the elements into the higher elements and then separates the elements and Prakriti from the jiva. So this is all to indicate that the first step in spiritual life is to identify ourselves as different from the material body and the world. And the material body has two parts, the gross and the subtle. So the jiva has to do this. But in bhakti, we don't actually do that. We're not always meditating, I am not the body, I am the soul, and start merging our elements into the higher elements. We don't have a process like that. So in bhakti, the process of distinguishing the atma from the material body is automatically accomplished through our process. So how is that possible? So actually everything is accomplished. The goals of jnana and yoga are automatically accomplished through the process of bhakti without any extra endeavor, but without following the same process. Now to do this process is difficult because, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, we're embodied persons, and this Brahman is quite different from what we are in the material world, so to shift our identity over to that purely spiritual entity is quite difficult for us. Plus, we have to do activities, we have to do so many things, and when we try to separate ourselves, we're trying to suppress the activities of the body and the senses, etc., and the mind, so it's a little bit difficult to do. And we see that we have that picture of the yogi at the front of the easy journey to other planets, or the in the Bhagavad Gita, where he's got all these vines growing around his body because he's been meditating for many, many years, and his body is all emaciated because he's not eating. So he's attempting to follow the yoga process of separating the body from the senses and the mind, and the senses and the body from the atma. In fact, the second sutra, the Vedanta sutras, is chitta vritti nirodha, to stop or to destroy the functions of material consciousness. All your thoughts, you have to get rid of them all. Of course, we find lesser, reflections of that in modern yoga systems, and what is it that mindfulness and all these processes, stopping your thoughts, etc. So. That comes from this idea that all these thoughts are useless and they entrap us in the material world. And that is true, they do. But it's very difficult to get rid of those thoughts and the actions of the mind and the actions of the senses and the actions of the body. It's very difficult to do that. Okay? So instead of using that process, the devotees use another process. And instead of suppressing the senses and the mind and the body, we engage them. And that was the definition of sadhana bhakti, kriti sadhya, to engage the senses and mind, to attain the state of bhava, or love of the Supreme Lord, establish a loving relationship with the Lord. So that's the endeavor that we make. We don't stop the senses, but we engage the senses in different things, engage the mind. Don't stop the mind, but we let the mind think, but let it think of Supreme Lord, that's all. So the Mayavadi, of course, also uses the mind, or the yogi uses the mind also, but ultimately to concentrate upon being Brahman. And what is Brahman? No form, no qualities, no activities at all. So it becomes a little difficult to use the mind in that way. Yeah? But the mind automatically is thinking of things and events. So let us think of nice things, Krishna, who's got beautiful form. Let us think of nice events, Krishna's pastimes. Yeah? So this is an alternative. Now, of course, the impersonalist will object, well, you're back in the material world, you have thoughts, you're doing all this, and then you become attached to these material images, so you're back in the material world again, and you can't get free of karma. But that form of the Lord, with his wonderful qualities and his activities, is not material at all. So that's the difference. But if you cannot accept the form and qualities and activities of a Supreme Lord, then you're stuck with the Brahman only. And you have to concentrate on that formless something, and it's very difficult to do. But if you can accept a beautiful form of the Lord, a person who has wonderful qualities, wonderful activities, then it's easy to concentrate the mind, and not difficult. In fact, in this world, that's what people do. They concentrate on things which are beautiful, or people who are, they think are beautiful, or whatever, and they become absorbed in those things. And these become their goals in life. It may be people or maybe things. They may concentrate on getting a car or a fancy car, or they may concentrate on, a man may concentrate on a beautiful woman, and a woman concentrates on a handsome man or whatever like that. And they may concentrate to a high degree. That's why we have heroes in the material world. We may have sports heroes or actress heroes or actor heroes or whatever like that. All sorts of things we concentrate on as our goal. So it's not difficult to do that in the material world. And automatically people are doing that all the time. They're concentrating on things that they're attracted to. So substitute is concentrate on the most attractive object, Supreme Lord. And in Kali Yuga, everyone is so fallen that Narada Muni told Veda Vyas, you tell people to concentrate on Krishna because of all the different forms of the Lord, he's the most attractive. He's got the most variegated activities of all the different forms of the Lord. He has the most attractive relationships. He has the most attractive form. So he has Madhurya Rupa, Madhurya Lila, Madhurya Venu. He's very attractive in all ways, so why not concentrate on Krishna? So that's, of course, the essence of Bhagavatam, that what should people do in Kali Yuga? Simply worship Krishna, concentrate on Krishna, and attain Krishna. So to do that, we use our mind and senses, etc. So instead of destroying our senses and merging our senses, etc., into the higher elements, into the mind, and the mind into the false ego, etc., instead of doing such a process, we engage, we don't worry about that. Instead, we engage all of these senses which are, in the normal, from the normal point of view, dangerous. We start engaging them in serving Krishna favorably. And then the result is, eventually, we develop spiritual senses. If we don't engage the senses at all, as in for the impersonalist, what happens? They get liberation and they have no senses. They don't see anything. They don't smell anything. They don't hear anything. They don't have a body. But if the devotee uses his senses for Krishna, anukulya, with a loving attitude, then the Atma manifests senses and body to perceive Krishna and to serve him. It's only a natural result. So, therefore, we replace our material senses with spiritual senses. In the meantime, however, we do have a material body subject to the material elements. But Vishnu Chakravarti describes, when you perform devotional service, even though we can call them material senses, which are destructible, the material mind, which is destructible, still, because they're engaged in the service of the Lord favorably, they become spiritualized. So therefore we don't condemn the senses. When they're engaged in devotional service, they become spiritualized. They're not any longer material senses, they're special senses. Another way of looking at it is bhakti. We think of bhakti as just doing some activities, devotional service. Actually, it's a shakti of the Lord. It is part of his sarup shakti, or internal energy, his antaranga shakti. And it's described in the bhava stage, it manifests as planidi and samvit shaktis, which are part of the internal shakti. So this bhakti, in other words, is a shakti of the Supreme Lord. And it's never contaminated by anything in the material world. Like the holy name also is Shakti of the Lord, so it's not contaminated by anything in the world. So Bhakti Shakti is also not contaminated by anything in this world. So when we do devotional service, then actually that's the Shakti of the Supreme Lord operating. And that as one progresses in bhakti, that Shakti begins to manifest a little more and a little more. In the beginning it's very weak, and it gets manifest more and more and more and more. Until in bhava stage, you can perceive the Lord. So what that means is, the Shakti is manifested to the extent that Hladini and Samvit are manifesting. So with the Samvit Shakti, you can perceive the Lord, you can hear the Lord, you can touch the Lord. So in other words, the Bhakti Shakti, its growth, it manifests the spiritual body and the spiritual senses and spiritual perception for the jiva. And then it goes further in prema, it fully develops in prema. Until you completely lost your contact, you forget about your material body and the senses completely. And then you just walk out of your body and that's it. So that's how Vishwa Chagavari describes the person in prema. Well, he's still in this world and then he's looking at everything, but he sees it all in terms of spiritual world almost. He identifies everything with the spiritual world. No longer makes distinctions. And meanwhile, when he is not looking at this world, he's in the spiritual world. His consciousness is somewhere else and he's participating in pastimes with Krishna. And then finally he just walks into those pastimes completely and he just forgets about his material body. And then he's in the spiritual world, finally. So he doesn't have to follow this process of amalgamating the senses and this, going upwards in this way and then rejecting the material body. It automatically takes place by the, we can say, his final birth, his birth with the spiritual body. When that manifests in bhava and prema, then he just rejects that material body. It no longer functions for him. So that is the process of how the devotee manages to separate the atma from the material elements in the body, etc. It's not so, it's a secondary feature of his developing his spiritual body and developing prema. So that is why in devotional service we don't talk about all these things, processes like this. However, it is quite common for other people, for yogis and gyanis, etc. It's a well-known process, so therefore it's described in terms of that for such persons. But persons like Yudhisthira don't even have to do this at all because they already have a spiritual body. They're already part of Krishna's pastimes, so there's no problem for them at all. But this is described to show that they're becoming detached from the material world and they renounce and everything when they don't have to, but they're doing it as a pastime to illustrate the duties of royal families and kings for the common people, that they at a certain time they should renounce. And therefore Prabhupada in the previous purport was mentioning how it's the duty of the leader to renounce, and set it a good example for the people to become detached from material life and become more absorbed in spiritual life. But there is no problem for the Pandavas. They're already completely attached to Krishna. They are his friends. They are his relatives. So it's only an example that they're setting for others. So here it describes how the he calls him Muni. He's a great sage. Even though he's a kshatriya and was a king, and he's a great sage now. And in the word for word, it translates Muni as the thoughtful. So the Muni means one who's thinking a lot. So it often has a negative concept of Munis, or people who keep thinking and thinking and thinking. They're more like jnanis, and they're always using their intellect to analyze things. But here it doesn't have that negative meaning. It just means he was very wise and intelligent, so therefore he was able to follow this process very nicely of becoming detached from the material body and rejecting it completely. So he merged all the elements, and then he merged everything into the Atma. So in other words, nothing was left, only Atma's there. And then besides the Atma, there was the Brahman. And he merged, or he offered everything into the Brahman, which is avyaya, which is eternal and indestructible and undecaying. So this is taken, will be taken by the impersonalist. So therefore, the jiva merges into Brahman. It gets offered into it like that. But the other way of looking at it is this: the offering. We'll see that Prabhupada often translates this offering as, and once as a juhot, amalgamated. He joined together the body into the prakriti, etc. And then he says, fixed ajuhavit, he fixed the Atma in the Supreme Brahman. So in other words, doesn't he emerge completely and lost his identity, but rather he just met with Supreme Lord and had fixed himself in the Supreme Lord completely. Yeah? So that's the Vaishnava way of taking these verses, that ultimately it's a process by which the devotee gets his, he fixes his connection with the Supreme Lord. We see elsewhere, sometimes it talks about yuj, which means, it can mean joining or merging. Like yoga also can mean the same thing, joining or merging or uniting. Or that the jiva enters into viṣate. He enters into the Supreme Brahman. So then the impersonal say, okay, here's a jiva merging in Brahman. But then our acharyas comment that this does not mean actually that it merges, but he meets and joins with the Lord. Yeah? So that's the other meaning of yuj, to meet with. The jiva meets with the Lord, but he doesn't merge into his completely. Yeah? In the same sense as mil means also in one sense to join together and merge, but mil also means simply to meet, and we have Milan, that means the couple, Radha and Krishna. So they never merge into each other, but they're joined together permanently in love. So that's Milana. So many words can be used in various contexts to mean different things, and we can stretch the words one way or the other. So we can take impersonal meaning out of it, or we can take personal meaning out of these descriptions. So the gyanis and yogis and impersonalists will often take the Bhagavatam, and when they find verses like this, then they'll say, this is proof that ultimately everything merges in Brahman. Right? And even at the end of the Bhagavatam, there is, and when after 10th canto, Sukadeva describes all of Krishna's wonderful pastimes, 11th canto, Krishna describes to Uddhava so many things, teachings. And then 12th canto, everything is wound up, the description of destruction of everything finally. And then Sukadev concludes. And he says, now, I've discussed everything. So it's time to merge in Brahman. He makes a statement like that. So this is, and those who are impersonalists take those statements very seriously. This means that the conclusion of Bhagavatam is merging in Brahman. Because that's exactly what Sukadeva tells Parikshit. Now you merge in Brahman after hearing all the wonderful pastimes of Krishna. You merge in Brahman. It's, therefore, Brahman, the impersonal, superior to the personal. Okay, Krishna may be God or whatever and have all wonderful pastimes, but that's all variety and form. So then you merge finally in Brahman with no qualities and no pastimes. Huh? Because Sukadeva is saying this also. Well, that's the conclusion of Bhagavatam. It comes at the end of Bhagavatam. That's his conclusion. So, and they will quote these verses to show that the impersonal superior to the personal. However, if we look carefully at the whole Bhagavatam and even at the Bhagavad Gita, then we'll see that this is contradicted by so many statements. Throughout the Bhagavatam, we'll see how the impersonal is completely condemned, that Brahman, they say it's inferior to the, it's like a little water in the desert, or like the water in a calf's footprint or whatever, compared to the ocean, it's nothing like that. So we find so many statements, and actually we'll see in the Nectar of Devotion, describing how the devotee derides liberation. Moksha, Lugudakrit, that's the third quality of bhakti. unique quality. The devotees say reject liberation as being useless. And then he gives about 50 quotes from Bhagavatam and other scriptures how the devotees deride liberation. Yeah? So that's one feature of the Bhagavatam. It derides liberation, merging in Brahman. So then how can Sukadeva at the end of the Bhagavatam say now it's time to merge in Brahman if he's already rejected it so many times? So it's a contradiction. Yeah? So that's the case of having to use your intelligence to find the meaning of Bhagavatam, just like this verse also. People say, okay, now the greatest devotees are going into Brahman, emerging in Brahman finally, so that means impersonal mukti is greater than bhakti. But we see so much contradiction in the whole Bhagavatam. And of course, the very purpose of Narada Muni, when he tells Vedavyasa, you have to describe Krishna, is you don't merge. You worship Krishna, you don't merge into him. The whole purpose of Bhagavatam, to glorify Krishna as the object of worship, not to merge into him. So much contradiction is there. So therefore, we have to say that superficial meaning is not correct. And then we have to look for another meaning. And of course, if we just look at the next verses where Parikshit replies to Sukadev, Parikshit rejects that conclusion of Sukadev, who was his guru. This is not true. This is all nonsense. We don't merge. So, therefore, we understand it was a little bit of a test of Sukadev to see how alert Parikshit was. So, Parikshit gets a little angry and says, this is nonsense. We don't accept this. Therefore, we do have to be careful when we see verses that look impersonal, that we also understand the context and we see the whole of the Bhagavatam, and then we can get the real meaning. So that's why it's pointed out that Vishnu Chakravarti makes that point that the Bhagavatam is like Mohini. And Mohini means bewildering, and particularly it refers to the Mohini avatar, who was also in charge of the layer of Prakriti in the Brihadbhagavatamrita. So Mohini is a very beautiful. And she was so beautiful that without fighting or anything, she bewildered the demons and was able to take the nectar from them. After great endeavor, the demons had got the nectar. They stole it from the devatas after they churned the milky ocean together and got the nectar. Then the demons stole it. So it was their prized possession after much labor. And of course, it's valuable because if you drink the nectar when you're dying, you take it, you're back to life. You're very energetic again. So they could never be conquered by the devatas. So then Mohini came, and then they were so bewildered by Mohini and her beauty that when she spoke, whatever she said, they would do simply because of her voice. So she said, give me the nectar. And they said, yes. They gave her the nectar. And then she took the nectar and gave it to the devatas. And that was the end of the demons. So Bhagavatam is like that. It bewilders the demons, impersonalists, materialists, and others. And it gives the nectar of the Bhagavatam to the devotees. So it may hide things like this. And then the demons pick up something. Liberation supreme. But ultimately, it isn't. But the Bhagavatam may hide the meaning sometime for these people, and they can take some other meaning out of the Bhagavatam. Just as Mohini bewilders the demons, so Bhagavatam will also bewilder the demons, and they give them all sorts of opportunities to find some impersonal meaning. Therefore, we do have to be careful when we read Bhagavatam and use our intelligence, and to help us, therefore, we have the acharyas who will give us the explanation, the real meaning of it, so we don't get bewildered. Okay, any question?
As you were saying, Sukadeva Goswami mentions that liberation is the goal of
But I
thought, I don't know if you could speak on, I've heard that actually, like for devotees, the conclusion of Bhagavatam is to do Sankirtan. Like especially in this age where we are now, purpose of writing it, like in the Brihad Bhagavatam Rita. That's always encourages to do Sankirtan. So is that a conclusion we could draw from it? Is it that we should do Sankirtan in the mood of Vrindavan?
Well, the Bhagavatam's conclusion is worship Krishna and attain Krishna to get Krishna prema. Mm. And then as sadhana, the main process is nam sankirtan. Mm. And then, as I mentioned, that's an eternal process, so it goes on with the gopis, even in the spiritual world. So therefore, it's an eternal process among the processes. They're all eternal, but that's the main process. So therefore, that activity goes on now and in the spiritual world, in both places. So it's an eternal activity, and it's a principal activity also. But it's the means for us to get to prema, and it also is prema. Yeah, I guess so.
Yes, yeah, in relation to creation.
Yeah.
Like for example, the Brahma Samhita was sung by Brahma at the end of his meditation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the Bhagavatam, when we read the creation, he says nothing about Goloka or the Vrinda or the cows.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks about Vaikuntha Loka and Narayana, his four arms. So I was just wondering, how come? Because it's two
different descriptions. Okay, fine. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so we find that there are different descriptions of different things, not only creation, but other things. Even the Varaha incident, it apparently takes place twice within the day of Brahma, but they're kind of merged together in many places. Once in the Swayambhuva Manvantara, once in the Chakshusha Manvantara. That's the first 71 yuga cycles, and that portion Varaha appears. Then he appears in the fifth section of the day, just before noon, Brahma's life. Again he appears, but then the two events are kind of merged into one. And we'll find other events also, different creations also, different descriptions of creation, how it takes place. The details are somewhat different. And similarly we'll find here the creation of, in the Bhagavatam, third canto, looks a little bit different from Brahma's realization in the Brahma Samhita. So we shouldn't confuse, what we can say that actually there's a little bit of this creation going on every day of Brahma. When he wakes up, then he doesn't know what to do. And so that whole thing where he's looking around in the water, that can occur every day of Brahma, then he has to start recreating everything again. Huh? Of course, the upper planets are kind of there, but the lower planets are all destroyed. Huh? And of course, it also takes place when he's born, the first day of Brahma in his life, and that's also there when he's bewildered. The events can say are repetitive, but then there's always variations as well. So every day when he wakes up, he may have a bewilderment, but then there may be different incidents what happens. So again, this whole Brahma Samhita may come up in one one day of Brahma at the very beginning, like that. However, the Brahma Samhita, of course, shows how Brahma realizes Krishna, not Vishnu. And in the version of the Bhagavatam here, in the third canto, it looks like Brahma sees Vishnu. But I think it is Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. He says, actually, look carefully, it doesn't actually say Vishnu here. So this is actually Krishna. He had a very young form. He goes his young form with beautiful toes and beautiful face, etc. And even his associates, he says, his associates can be not just Vaikuntha, they're also associates of Krishna. So therefore, he says, actually refers to Krishna, because Krishna is the conclusion of Bhagavatam, so therefore, Brahma's vision here is also Krishna. So he defends the vision of Krishna there, even though we don't see details like gopis and cowherd boys running around. But we do see the beautiful form described, so it could also be taken for Krishna. So he says, actually, he got a vision of Krishna at that time. There? Yeah. But in other places, he gives them, he has a very youthful form. And he's got a very youthful form there. He's like a Navayovana form. So then Vishnu takes those as being Krishna. Of course, even Krishna can display four arms as he does in Dwarka. But anyway, the idea is that there are variations within the creation and sub-creation, etc. We find that even Shiva gets created in different ways at different times as well. I think in the Brahma Samhita he doesn't come out of his forehead, but in the Bhagavatam he comes out of the forehead of Brahma, like that. So I think he comes out of a side or something instead. So there are details which differ in different cycles of time or different days or different universes. We'll find a big difference in the way that the Mahabharata describes the disappearance of Parikshit, you know, how he is fasting, etc., and he's puts himself on an island to protect himself, whatever like that. But we don't see any of that in the Bhagavatam version, so the acharyas say different kalpa, different day of Brahma. It's happened.
So, the same event?
Yeah, the Parikshit and, you know, getting bit by the snake and all that, but it's quite different. The whole the details are quite different.
What about if you look going back a few, actually, the text coming up here, where he decides to go to the forest and he leaves on his own, his brothers follow away, all ladies stay back in the palace. But you read the Mahabharata,
And of course, then they have that whole thing, the vision of hell and all these things on the way. So, interpolated. And that's another thing that what is being added on later may be different. The other is that sometimes the acharyas will say this is another kalpa. They say there's a difference here or a difference there, so it's not another kalpa. For instance, we have the story of I think Lalita Madhava, the Rupa Goswami's work, where the gopis get reincarnated in Dwarka. But then if that happened, and it was a whole story of how they disappeared. But then the objection to that is, well, look, Krishna met them all in Kurukshetra. They didn't disappear. They were still there. So he says, different kalpa. So the story of Lajit Mahava is a different kalpa, he says.
But then how do you understand which stories are actually bona fide and which aren't?
Well, they're all bona fide, but from different days of Brahma, so some details are different. That could be also. Yeah. So we just take what the acharyas give us. We take those texts. So we accept the Bhagavatam here, and then with the commentaries of the acharyas, so we take these as the actual events for this particular kalpa, and then the other things may be different kalpas or whatever. The thing is that the itihasas and puranas are written by Veda Vyas, and the writing may be different. It's not always eternal like the Shrutis, the Vedas, which are permanent and they never change. So the events that are mentioned in the Puranas and the Mahabharata may be changed in different days of Brahma slightly, because they don't do everything exactly the same. There's a slight difference. So therefore, that's why we may get differing events that look quite this similar event, but it's slightly different because of that.
I once had a vision, like in a meditation, that like the same thing had happened, like I was in like a spiral basically, and the same thing had happened over and over again, but each time it was just slightly different. So it was like a spiral, where I still think of the cycle of time as just the same thing in a circle. So it sounds like what you're talking about, that it slightly changes each time, it's more like a spiral. The time works like that.
Well, of course, Krishna goes from universe to universe also, and it's not exactly the same pastime, exactly whatever, you know, but it's similar, but and he's doing it consecutively, one after the other in different universes. In fact, it is said that each event is eternal, because as soon as it happens here, then it happens in another universe, and then another universe, another universe, another universe, another universe. So the same event is sequentially happening. Krishna's appearance in the prison of Kamsa is happening in each universe, one after the other. So even his appearance is eternal. In that sense, it goes on in all the universes, one after the other, for the whole life of Brahma. So it's another way of looking at it.
So just following up on the comment you were making a minute ago about the itihasas and puranas not being eternal.
The events are slightly different, yeah.
The events are slightly different. The Vedas and
the sounds, every words, everything is...
They're all eternal.
Yeah.
Right. What about Bhagavatam?
Well, similarly, some of the events here may change, like it may be different couples of time, perhaps. Yeah? But ultimately, they're eternal in the sense that the ideas are eternal. Whatever is presented in here is actually reflecting what's in the Vedas also. So those ideas are eternal. But then the words may be slightly different or whatever. Yeah. If Sukadeva comes and recites it again, then he may add a few more verses here, a few verses there, add a few chapters or whatever.
It's like in the Mahabharata's name, different versions, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, whatever.
Another argument that some people from other philosophical schools and sampradayas say is that actually before Krishna appeared in Dwapara Yuga, we don't have any, they say the only thing you have is Brahma Samhita and Srimad Bhagavatam. In other Upanishads and in the Vedas in general, the Krishna is never mentioned.
Okay.
Only Narayana.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you
Well, in this presentation of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the mention was made that bhakti is very rare. Yeah, like karmakanda and material things are quite common because most people are not qualified and they're interested in living in this material world. So we've got a lot of karma scriptures, karma yoga scriptures. Less people are interested in jnana. But there is some jnana scriptures, so therefore we have a whole group of Upanishads which look like they're all jnana. Bhakti is rarer, and therefore there's less scriptures on that. And bhakti to Krishna is even rarer, so less things on that. Huh? Nevertheless, because they're rarer doesn't mean they're not correct. And of course our acharyas go through the process of showing how, yes, Krishna is mentioned in Upanishads also. And even Prabhupada quotes that from Chandogya Upanishad in the first verse commentary in the Bhagavatam, he quotes there. This son of, was it Vasudeva or something like that? Son of Vasudeva. So he quotes there, and of course then we have the one Upanishad, Gopal Tapan Upanishad, which is all about Krishna and Radha, which is Shruti. It's going to be Shruti. It comes from the Atharva Veda. So it's not completely absent, but it's a little bit rarer. And of course, in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita presentation, when Gopal Kumar was Brahma. He became Brahma. And then he had an assembly and all the scriptures were there having a debate. So the principal Upanishads were saying, you got to do jnana for liberation. That's the only way of getting liberation. And then the other Upanishads, no, actually, bhakti is also a process. And then says some confidential Upanishads say that actually liberation is not even useful for us. We reject it. So that the confidential Upanishads are like Gopal Tapani Upanishad, or Ram Tapani Upanishad, or Nrsinga Tapani Upanishad. So there are some Srutis also, but they're lesser and not so prominent, so therefore people ignore them, but they're there. So even in the Srutis there is works. But it is a little bit hidden because it's not common for people. People are not so attracted to that. They're attracted to other things. However, to make things clearer for us, Vedavyas finally came out with the Bhagavatam. After compiling the Vedas and realizing people could not access them, he wrote the Brahma Sutras to get the essence of the Upanishads. And that's what Brahma Sutra is. But then Brahma Sutra is too difficult for people also. So he wrote Mahabharata and Puranas for people. Particularly the people of Kali, which has got more stories in it, less philosophy, things like that. But even then, it was not so useful, and that's why this gets condemned in the first canto of Bhagavatam even. Narada Muni comes to Vedavyasa and says, this is not proper to tell people to worship Shiva and Tamagun and worship Brahma and Rajagun and worship Vishnu and Sattvagun according to qualification, have different worships. He said, people in Kali Yuga just get confused by all of this. They're too lazy. They won't understand. So just tell everyone to worship Krishna. So then, the last Purana is Bhagavatam as we see it here, where Krishna is pointed out as the final object to worship. So, therefore, Jiva Goswami concludes that though there are all sorts of scriptures, Vedas and Smritis and whatever, and Puranas, everything, the conclusion is Bhagavatam, the final work for the people of Kali Yuga. So therefore, we just read this, we'll get the final conclusion. So it may be rare in the Vedas, not so much mentioned, but it is the final conclusion.
Yeah. General,
no worship of Krishna.
Narayana, right?
Yes. Yeah. No. Yeah. So it's rare.
Because every time I read something in the Bhagavatam, they never
meditate. Yeah. It's mainly Vishnu and other forms of the Lord. Yeah. So it's rare. Let's say Krishna is rare. Yeah. And very difficult. Even Brahma gets a little bit puzzled by the whole Krishna's, because he can't understand it. He acts so much like a human being, etc. So Lord Chaitanya comes to reveal Krishna in Kali Yuga and make Krishna accessible to the people of Kali Yuga. Otherwise, people cannot get it. Even if they have Bhagavatam, they still can't understand Krishna properly. So, Lord Chaitanya comes.
There's another doubt that I have, that when Brahma gets bewildered by saying Krishna, yet in the Brahma Samhita,
saying
that the Supreme Personality of
God. Yeah. So how did he get bewildered? So it's explained, a bewilderment was Yoga Maya. He couldn't get bewildered in this lifetime because Supreme Lord promised him in the Bhagavatam at the beginning, the first when he was born, you'll never be bewildered in your lifetime. So then how did he get bewildered? And he took away the calves and cows? Will of Krishna for pastimes. So therefore, don't blame Brahma. It wasn't his fault.
So this first and the last verse seem to be like a process of purification.
Oh, in a sense, it's like that, yeah, it's like that. Yeah, purification, separate the soul from the body, yeah.
So it seems like it's, you know, like we practice it in Hindu worship, but it seems like, you know, for advanced yogis, this is a process that's actually understood and it's something they do.
Yeah. It's similar to Bhutta Suti, yeah. And if you look at the one in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, it's quite interesting how they do that Bhutta Suti. They take the Atma and I think put them at the top of the head, and then they meditate on their material body, and they start burning, and they think of him as a personification of all sins, as a wild-looking man with red hair sitting in the bottom of your stomach, all fiery, really angry guy. Huh? And then you take the fire bija, rum, and you burn them up. And then first you dry them up, and then you burn them up like that. And then you get rid of all your sinful activities, you know, all your sinful body, etc., all your desires, etc. And then finally you meditate on the tam bij, amrita bij, on the top of your head, inundating your body with amrita, nectar. So you get a spiritualized body, etc. Then you bring the atma down back in here, and so that the atma's operating, it's got a pure body, a spiritualized body. Yeah, destroy the material body, and they amalgamate the elements here into the higher element. Finally, there's no material body, and you got your spirit soul left. You know, so it's a way of getting rid of the impurities of the body. Okay, Hare Krishna.